This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, this country is facing the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression.
Today, we'll talk with the extraordinary Rick Wolf, who explains it how it is.
We'll take a look at class warfare and the upcoming May Day demonstrations planned around the country.
We're seeing a major resurgence of the working class movement in this country. Today, we'll hear from Daniel Gross, from Brand Workers, one of the major organizations organizing food workers in New York City.
We'll talk with founding member and director of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance, Bharavi Desai. Desai's activism has created a solidarity with immigrant workers around the world, especially in third world countries where people are forced to migrate to the U.S. for jobs. Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
This is a special Law and Disorder show on class warfare. Why are we doing this now? In some way, the answer seems obvious. The world is going through huge changes. Here in the United States, you have class warfare in Wisconsin, in Ohio, and in other states. In Egypt, you have class warfare between the working class and the people who control that society. Well, this special, we bring you a working class organizer, a union organizer, and a Marxist economist who will try and help us all understand what is the class struggle going on now and what can we expect in the future. Welcome to this special edition of Law and Disorder on class warfare.
The United States is in the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. Why we got here and what to do about it are some of the topics we'll be speaking to Professor Rick Wolf about. In a recent article called Debts, Truth, and Lies in the U.S., Rick suggests that state and local governments can become less dependent on the federal government and corporations. Instead of giving unemployment compensation to workers, state and local governments could, for example, restart their economies by providing the unemployed with capital to start businesses. Rick Wolf joins us in the studio for this exclusive National Pacifica broadcast. Rick has a new radio show on WBAI here in New York City called The Economic Update. It airs at noon every Saturday. Rick is professor of economics emeritus, University of Massachusetts Amherst, where he taught economics from 1973 to 2008. He is currently a visiting professor in the graduate program in international affairs at the New School University in New York City.
Rick Wolf, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Rick, class warfare, a term that had been out of fashion for many years, is now being openly discussed, and you see what's been going on from Egypt to Wisconsin. What's your take on it?
Well, I've always been struck here in the United States that most of the time we're not supposed to talk about class warfare as if it either doesn't exist or only existed a long time ago. Then, periodically, when liberal folks want to raise taxes a little bit on corporations and the rich or do something else that's slightly progressive, we suddenly hear howls and screams from those who might be affected that this all amounts to class war. The truth, of course, it doesn't work quite that way. Over the last 30 or 40 years, taxes on corporations and taxes on the richest Americans have been systematically dropped. I like to remind people that in the 50s and 60s, the income tax bracket for the richest Americans was 91%. Today, it's 35%. That's a tax cut that dwarfs everybody else, and it went only to those at the top.
I have a question. As you continue on this, Michael mentioned class warfare. You mentioned it. What are the classes we're talking about?
Well, most of the time when this is discussed, it's a simple idea. One class are the rich, another class are the poor. Sometimes it gets a little bit more complicated. Then there's the class of corporations as distinguished from individuals. And you might even get a story, because it's part of our history as a nation, that big business is a class that's different from little and small businesses, and there's a war there.
But what about proletariat and working class and all those Marxist terms that we learned?
Yeah, those were all put out of our language during the Cold War. It was not allowed to think like that, or talk like that, and we all made believe that we didn't have classes anymore, that America was beyond classes. I always found it charming that the Soviet Union and the United States, who agreed on so little, both agreed that in their respective societies there were no more classes, but they only existed in the other one.
But do we have classes? I mean, we have rich people. Yes, we have poor people. We have people who are very rich, you know, the top 400. We have very poor people. We have people who aren't in unions, who are working class. What do we have here?
Well, if you use the concept of class in terms of income groups, rich and poor, that's fine. That's about 5,000 years old. You can find in ancient Greece struggles between groups of people who referred to each other as classes and who meant by that you either have or you don't have wealth. There's another very old concept of class. Do you or do you not have power? Do you tell other people what to do? That's the idea of like a ruling class and the ruled. The interesting thing is those ideas are both very old and the ones that are still around. The real idea of class that is not discussed much is the one brought up by that remarkable thinker Karl Marx in the 19th century when he informed us there's another way of thinking about class, and that's thinking about it not in terms of who owns what or who tells who what to do, but in terms of how you participate in the production process. Are you the kind of person, like most of us, who goes to work 9 to 5, 5 days a week, and produces an output? Or are you the kind of person who hires someone else to do that? And Marx argued that the class of people who go to work every day are properly to be called a class because of something very peculiar that happens in production. They produce more than they get paid. Now, every worker knows that. You all know, every listener to this program, that if anyone's going to pay you $20 an hour to do something, it's only because during that hour, your work will produce more than 20 for your employer to take and sell. Otherwise, there's nothing in it for him to do that. And you've all understood that. Marx said, yeah, we've all understood it, but we didn't quite think it through. If the mass of people are producing what Marx called that extra or that surplus, and the employer draws it into his hands, it gives the employer an enormous advantage over the worker because the employer has all that wealth, the surplus contributed to by all workers, in his own hands. And think of it, here in America, we have 300 million people who live here, and we have 500 large corporations that do most of the business. So the surplus is concentrated here and helps then to explain, if you use Marx's concepts, that in our society, the class of working people is large, but produces so much wealth for the small class of employing people that the latter class is able to control our politics, both parties, and shape our society because of this class system in production. But that's a different way of thinking about it from classes rich and poor or powerful and powerless.
Well, how should we think about it? In talking about the cutbacks, tax decreases for the wealthy, the breaking of the unions in Wisconsin, I mean, should we talk about it as rich and poor and power, or should we talk about it as means of production and who's in the means of production and who gets the surplus wealth?
Well, far be it from me to tell anyone how to think, but let me respond in a general way. The history of the world is a struggle over doing something about the extremes of wealth and poverty on the one hand and powerful and powerless. In America, we celebrate democracy, which, if you think about it, is an attempt to equalize the power distribution, even if we don't talk anymore about equalizing the wealth. Here's the problem. There have been many efforts, sometimes successful, to equalize wealth, to equalize power, but they don't seem to last very long. And Marx noticed that too and asked himself the question, why not? And in trying to answer the question, he came up with a particular answer. The efforts to equalize wealth and to equalize power didn't deal with the organization of production. They should have, he said. Because if we don't deal with that basic part of life, let's remember, production, that's where the goods and services we depend on every day come from. Production, that's what we do 5 out of 7 days, all day of the working day of that period of time. It's what we mostly do in our adult lives. If we don't change that, Marx says, then even when we do something good in the realm of wealth equality and power equality, we still leave in the hands of those who get the surplus the power to undo even those progressive changes we made. If you think about the last 30 years of American history, we have undone the reforms of the New Deal. And who led the charge? Business. They used the surpluses they got from the workers to undo the Social Security, the unemployment insurance, the Glass-Steagall Act controlling banks, and a thousand other things. That's why it's, in my humble opinion, it's a bit strange today to hear my fellow liberals asking for new reforms of the banking system and new programs to help working people. It's all very nice, but if you don't deal with the organization of production, class in this sense of who produces the surplus and who gets it, then even if you struggle hard and even if you win a few reforms, they won't be secure. You can't rely on them. You can never let down because you haven't changed the production system. And that's the key issue, which is why Marx focused it on it and why it's such a loss in the world today if people forget the lessons Marx taught.
Well, Rick, what you're talking about, no private property in the great means of production. We're talking about no private owners of, say, the energy industry or the communications industry or the transportation industry. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about the whole population owning the top of the pyramid of the industrial capacity in this country. I understand that should be dismantled and reorganized and democratized. I understand that. But my question to you is, how do we get from where we are to where we want to be?
Let me respond first to what you said. I understand what you said about property, but let me take it a step further. I think the key issue is to reorganize the production process, to basically move to an idea that many, many Americans for a long time in our history have embraced and have endorsed. It's not a strange idea, not a foreign idea. In this country, it's called co-ops or cooperative. The idea is that the people who get together to do the work on a project ought to also be full participants in deciding what is done with the fruits of their labor. In other words, there's no reason why workers in America, enterprise by enterprise, could not function as follows. Monday to Thursday, they come to work and do their job, their particular task in the division of labor. Friday, they come to work and they don't do their particular task. They sit around all day in meetings and they decide what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the products they've produced. In effect, on Friday, they are their own collective, democratically operating board of directors. There is no longer any gap then between those who employ and those who are employed. They're the same people. They have to work inside their own minds the balance between these things. It isn't one group of people getting the surplus to reproduce their situation at the top of society and then manipulate everybody else to stay at the bottom, because we've overcome that gap. It's a little bit like saying we don't need a king to tell us what to do. We can govern ourselves. If that idea works in politics, Marx argued, why doesn't it work in the organization of production as well? If I can answer the second question about how we get from here to there, that's, of course, the $64 billion question. It's the right one to ask. And the honest truth is, I don't know, and I don't think anyone else knows. We have to talk to one another. We have to explain these issues. We have to share our concern honestly, to admit that we don't like the way our lives work and the way this society works and who calls the shots and who lives with the consequences. And then I have the confidence, because I'm a Democrat with a small d, I have the confidence that if people understand that, can share it with one another, you'll get the kind of organizations and movements that we have to have. I'm convinced we have to have organization, but that has to come out of the feelings and experience of the people as they struggle with their lives.
We've talked to you about this in the past. We're looking really as classes, the rich and the poor. A lot of what we discuss is that. And then if we can ever get through some of that, we move into worker control of production and making the decisions about what to do with surplus. But even on the rich-poor class is where this country has become incredibly skewed, as you have told us before. The number of people controlling the vast amount of wealth, I think the top 400 people control something like more wealth than 50% of the population of the United States.
That's right.
It's an extraordinary figure. And you've talked about how we cut back taxes for the rich. We've imposed austerity. And now there's what many would call a class war going on between the wealthy corporations, the wealthy, the unions, the unemployed, and others over what piece of the pie people are going to have. Now, that does fit a slightly different definition of class war. Hopefully, it would move to another stage. But talk about what's going on in the country on that issue, because we are seeing a resurgence right now.
Well, I think what you see are the consequences of this gap between a small number of corporations gathering the surplus into their hands and paying fantastic wealth, salaries and bonuses to their top executives, and paying well to certain of their professional employees and consultants and all of that. So we have 5, 6, 7% of Americans doing very, very well, really quite well, extraordinarily wealthy and all that, and the mass of people getting more and more worried. The problem is this is like a spiral that's getting worse. When you have that much wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, those few are not stupid. They understand that the gap between themselves and everybody else represents a risk which in a democratic political system, even one as limited as ours, the mass of people vote, and that's a lot more votes than the small. So the small have to begin, if they're going to stay wealthy the way they've become, to manage this situation. And the first order of business is to make the political system depend on them. So we have to have a political system controlled by money. It has to be run by TV ads, not by street organizations. It has to be run at such a level of expense for any candidate to get anywhere. And by the way, not just a candidate to win office, but once in office, to function in a way that keeps you in office, you need an army of staff people, which your budget from the government never gives you. So you have to rely on something called lobbyists. Lobbyists currently write more than anybody else of the legislation that gets passed. They're the real staff because they're paid by business that are interested, and they help the elected official stay in office. So between the money you need to get in and the money you need to stay in, your dependence on wealth is overwhelming.
What's amazing about what you said is, as you said, we have a democracy which could theoretically change how power is structured, change how money is structured. But of course, the money that now is allowed to pour into elections ensures that the wealthy are going to continue to control that democracy. And of course, we have a Supreme Court now that has said that's not just good, that's better than good. Corporations can put as much money as they want into campaigns. Individual rich people, whether it's our mayor here in the city, can pour hundreds of millions into a campaign. So it looks like, because of a variety of reasons, we're with this pretty permanently, it seems to me, in this country. I mean, it's going to be hard to change that.
Well, let me respond, though, on a couple of levels. You're seeing more and more candidates, particularly in the Republican Party, but not only in the Republican Party, who are genuinely excited and vigorous in their advocacy. Just last week, there was a new Republican congressman speaking publicly in Florida about the need to cut Social Security. Florida probably has more people on Social Security as a percent of its population than any other state in the United States. It's extraordinary to have a politician from such a state not only vote against Social Security, but be a champion. That's only explainable because in the world that that politician lives in, I'm guessing, it's so clear where the money comes from that makes you win that he doesn't have to worry about the general population. That's not his problem. His problem is the 2 or 3 dozen wealthy donors who are gung-ho for the very things he says, who will like him more and contribute more precisely because he keeps pushing the envelope. You know, empires in the past have always collapsed because those running of them didn't remember the limits. They went too far too soon and looked back on their excesses as what undid them. I agree. We don't have the movements yet in the United States, although Europe is quite different from us in this regard. But I think we're in the position of now watching, painful as it is, the inability of this system, having gone so far, to avoid the logical conclusion of pushing further and further. In Wisconsin, the unions had agreed with Governor Walker to give back on pensions, on medical coverage, on vacations, everything pretty much that the governor had asked. But he's so caught up in the euphoria of the wealth politics of America that he had to go for the next step and take away future collective bargaining rights of public employee unions on top. And that's a sign of the overstretch It's a little bit like, in labor relations, being already involved in three wars against Muslim people, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, and finding a way to start a fourth one. You have to wonder in your mind what logic is wrapped up in these people that they can't see the enormous dangers of how hard they're pushing in a direction that has so many pitfalls.
I was astounded that Scott Walker took it the next stretch, because what he did was he mobilized the population of the state of Wisconsin in the middle of the winter with snow falling from the sky. 2,000 guys on tractors drove into downtown Madison. I think the answer is greed, but it's kind of an institutionalized greed, and they really can't get out of their own way. They've got that momentum. They've got their marching orders from people like the Koch brothers, who help pay for Scott Walker's election. And that's what they have to do. But it's causing a reaction, and it's causing people below to reinvigorate the class struggle.
And isn't this an exciting time, actually?
Absolutely.
Aren't we in a moment? And we don't know what's going to happen.
That's right.
But Egypt and Wisconsin, I mean.
Everyone said, and by the way, not just folks on the left, but folks on the right who aren't stupid either, understood there's a risk if we keep pushing. I can assure you, having been present myself at some meetings of sizable boards of directors, that in most corporations, boards of directors can be split between those who think we've gotten away with it, we can push further, and those who say, don't be crazy. If we keep pushing, one day we'll be real sorry. That's a debate goes on inside boardrooms when they make decisions. What you have now is a peculiar process in which the skewing of the money that plays a role in our politics has gone so far that you have over and over again Republicans pushing forward with the enthusiasm of those who are on the payroll of the big companies. But in the boardrooms of the companies, there's growing anxiety that the Tea Party folks are out of control. I hear much harsher condemnations of the extreme right in the Republican Party from businessmen and women in the financial industry of New York than I hear from most commentators on the media in the United States. So there is, not just from below, but everyone sees what happened in Wisconsin. The mass uprising confounded what Governor Walker expected, what the Democrats expected, what the leaders of the trade unions expected. There is now a real recognition that this is a danger that may go far beyond Wisconsin, and there's all kinds of folks putting on the brakes. If you followed the recent news reports last weekend, 25th, 26th of March in the Wall Street Journal, there's a story, I forget whether it's about Ohio or Indiana, where the Republican Party is backing away from the extreme things because their polling is telling them there's a voter backlash building. And let me underscore the wisdom of that argument. Everything the Republicans are doing is making the condition for most Americans worse. You cut government services at a time of unemployment and housing disaster, you're making people's lives worse. If their neighbors who used to have jobs in the public sector lose those jobs, then the value of their homes and the way their homes look will deteriorate. What's happening is, under the heading of a great resurgence of Republicans, the conditions of people are actually deteriorating. And that's going to come back in rage against the Republicans, just like they got in a year ago in rage against Obama, who in turn got in rage against Bush. The pattern is pretty clear. And if I were a Republican strategist, I'd be very leery of this enthusiastic right wing. It didn't work in 1994 with Gingrich and those folks, and the conditions for them are worse now.
Well, in your opinion, do we need our own political party, or should we still try to stick with the Democrats? What should people do politically?
We have allowed in the last 40, 50 years our organizations of working people, trade unions, Socialist Party, Communist Party, all of those kinds of organizations, even social organizations of working people, to disappear. I might mention, if anyone's interested, a wonderful book written by a professor of sociology at Harvard named Putnam. And the book has a wonderful, weird title, Bowling Alone. Yeah. It was a bestseller. And the book documents in the 80s and 90s how Americans stopped engaging in civic activity, not just political activity, but social activity of every kind. And there was a kind of turning inward. More and more members of the family had to go to work to make living in the family, particularly the women, the adult women, had to leave America's homes in huge numbers to undertake paid work. Since their husbands didn't fill in, they therefore had paid work as an addition on top of the child care and home care that they had traditionally done. It stressed every family out, and one thing that gave way was public and civic participation. For 30 or 40 years, the organizations of the American working people atrophied. They died. And as they pulled back from politics, the moneyed interests, who were having more and more wealth anyway, came in to fill the gap, which is why our politics changed so much. In Europe, that didn't happen to anything like this extent. So you can see in Europe, the fight back against what's going on in states like Wisconsin is much more developed.
Or look, look at the self-organization of people in Egypt.
Right.
What they were able to do.
They're so extreme, they were able to come back quickly from no organization. But now that they threw out their dictator, the fact is they have to build organizations or else they'll never realize all the things that motivated them in that dramatic achievement that they did make. So I think Americans are either going to have to invent new organizations, and there are people doing that all over the United States now, are trying to, or they're going to have to revive the old ones, or some combination of those, because without organization, even the anger of the mass of people will not be able to become realized. I would point people to the fact that there have been several national polls taken since the events in Wisconsin, and they show the following. An overwhelming majority of Americans polled believe that the public employees should not be deprived of their collective bargaining rights. Even majorities of those who think that there should be money taken from the public employees and that they should give back and not get pensions still do not want to take away from workers the right to bargain over their conditions. They see that. We have let our organizations of working people atrophy. We either believe we didn't need them, like so many workers in America believe, don't need a union, as if what the union does is not beneficial to you, whether you're in the union or not. And we don't need leftist political parties. We can put all our hope in either great individual leaders, whom we get excited about every few years, or the Democratic Party, which is somehow going to do it for us, even though year after year goes by and it can't or it won't. So I think that people get depressed. You know, my wife's a psychotherapist, and so I'm very close to the quality and quantity of people flowing into her office who are upset by the way the world works. And that has markedly increased over recent years. But there's a lot of people that are depressed. I mean, we have to remember we have 5% of the world's population, and we consume 65% of the psychological drugs that are produced in this world that we live in. That is so out of whack that you have to think.
I never heard that.
Yeah,
I thought you were going to do the old Kennan quote of the population and what we consume, which is...
Well, that's already bad enough.
Right,
5%, we consume something like 20-something, 22% or whatever of the world's goods, which is already out of whack. But we are very upset people. And there's two ways of handling your upset. As an individual, and I'll give you some samples that you understand, by drinking too much, by eating too much. We have a national obesity problem. By relying on legal and illegal psychological drugs, uppers, downers, tranquilizers, antidepressants, the whole collection. Those are individual, or beating each other up, or kicking the dog, or all those ways. We do this socially. You know, I like to end my comments on this by saying, we face in the United States today a social problem. And a social problem requires a social solution. Individuals try to escape. But if you're a part of a society, which we all are, you can't. And you finally have to figure out a social problem. The problem of our economic system has to be overcome by a social movement. And that has to be organized. And we just have to do it.
And I want to remind our audience that Rick has a noon WBAI radio show. You can stream it on WBAI.org or get it in the tri-state area at 99.5 FM. Rick Wolf's new economic radio show. And Rick, what's it called?
It's called Economic Update, every Saturday, noon to 1.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you, Rick.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Now, if you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. You got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, it won't be long. You get shorter hours, better working conditions, vacations with pay, take your kids to the seashore. It ain't quite this simple, so I better explain just why you got to ride on the union train. Because if you wait for the boss to raise your pay, we'll all be a-waiting till Judgment Day. We'll all be buried, gone to heaven. St. Peter will be the straw boss then. Now you know you're underpaid, but the boss says you ain't. He speeds up the work till you're about to faint. You may be down and out, but you ain't beaten. You can pass out a leaflet and call a meeting, talk it over, speak your mind, decide to do something about it. Of course, the boss may persuade some poor damn fool to go to your meeting and act like a stool, but you can always tell a stool, though, well, that's a fact. He's got a yaller streaker running down his back. He doesn't have to stool.
The rights of organized labor, the benefits that workers have achieved over the last half century, are under attack in one of the worst economic downturns to hit the United States. Classic union-busting techniques used by corporations and the far right wing of the Republican Party have been employed to crush public workers just as they've stymied private workers in the past. In the last month, Republican governors in Wisconsin, Montana, Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey have targeted organized labor with insidious laws to dismantle fundamental union rights. The very right to collect dues and bargain collectively has been taken away or challenged. This anti-public union policy push has reignited progressive movement among unions in many states across the country and has resulted in some of the biggest demonstrations we've seen in years. We're joined today by attorney Daniel Gross, co-founder and executive director of Brand Workers International, a nonprofit organization protecting and advancing the rights of retail and food employees. We talk with him about the rights of union employees as legislatures strike at the heart of traditional organized labor.
Dan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
We've had you on a number of times. This is, of course, a special on class warfare in the United States, and of course, your work is very related. But first, give us just some impression. How are things at Brand Workers?
We've never been more excited. We've never been more mobilized, and I think that's true of the entire workers' movement. Our time has finally come.
What does that mean?
It means that for many decades now, there's been an existential assault being waged against workers organizing in the public sector and the private sector. That's now come to a head. There's nothing really new about the attack. What is new is how extreme it has become. And most excitingly, I think, is the level of resistance and upsurges that we're seeing amongst workers all around the country and, of course, the world.
Let's back up for a second and explain to our listeners what Brand Workers does.
Well, we're a nonprofit organization based here in New York City protecting and advancing the rights of retail and food employees. We have a major organizing effort called Focus on the Food Chain right now that's organizing with recent immigrant workers from Latin America and China against brutal sweatshop conditions at food warehouses that produce, process, and distribute a lot of the food we end up eating at the restaurants and markets of New York. So there's extremely brutal conditions, wage theft, discrimination, reckless disregard for health and safety of workers. We recently lost a compañero in the industry, Juan Baten, started working at the age of 16 at a tortilla factory called Tortilleria Chinantla, crushed to death in a mixing machine, and left a very young daughter and his partner behind. So that's the kind of shop that we're dealing with, the outright sweatshops. Still, though, workers have shown a tremendous ability and will to fight and lead and develop their skills as organizers, and some very hard-hitting campaigns are being deployed by workers in the sector.
I want to hear about those campaigns, but I just want to talk about the man who died in the mixing machine. This last week, we celebrated the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, in which 146 people were killed in a fire when the safety exits were locked. And of course, it caused a huge uproar, all kinds of new safety conditions. And yet we're still hearing about workers dying on the job, like the worker you mentioned. I mean, you think we've gotten better, but yet we're seeing workers die on the job.
Yeah, the more you scratch beneath the surface, you'll see that sweatshops, unfortunately, are alive and well in our society and, of course, around the world. In this particular shop, you had a very typical sweatshop in this food processing distribution corridor, which stretches from Brooklyn into Queens. Extremely long hours, no safety procedures, no safety training, and just an absolute, again, reckless disregard for the health and safety of workers. The message that we were trying to get out is twofold. One is that this shop, Tortilleria Chinantla, is not by any means an exception within this sector. Actually, it's absolutely emblematic of the norm, which is really a tremendous exploitation of recent immigrant workers. I'd go so far to say as the business model of these companies, how they compete in the marketplace against more established, in many cases, union operators, is by exploiting recent immigrant workers.
Now, the circumstances in New York, are those for the workers, food chain workers, are those reflected in other parts of the country as well?
Oh, absolutely. In other parts of the country as well, and also from farm to plate. We see mostly workers of color, mostly immigrant workers who are, you know, doing absolutely essential labor, really hard work, heavy, dangerous, in many cases working with heavy chemicals, the work to bring us the food that we all need to survive and thrive. But these workers are highly exploited. It's something that we should all be concerned about, and we should all respond in solidarity when we hear from these workers, whether it's the workers in the tomato fields or the workers in restaurants and supermarkets, workers fighting Walmart from entering New York and other communities around the country. It's absolutely tremendous fight for us all to get involved in.
Dan Gross, the first time I met you was through a mutual friend who was your attorney at the time, Len Weinglass.
That's right.
Len was representing you, I remember, when you were organizing Starbucks, speaking of the food chain, Starbucks workers into the IWW. One of the holidays that the IWW put on the map was May Day. And I wanted to ask you what your plans are for May Day here in New York and nationwide.
First, why is it on the map, and then why are you making plans?
First, let me say that Len Weinglass was a real champion of the organizing campaign at Starbucks. Almost every time he and I were in the same room, he'd be giving a speech. No matter the topic, he'd always take a minute or two to talk about the campaign and the diligent representation he provided me personally. So we've all lost a very committed revolutionary and an extremely brilliant lawyer, and I'm happy that you mentioned Len, and I know his legacy will live on, and he's inspired many of us around the country and indeed around the world. Brand Workers was one of now over 40 groups around the country, worker and community-based organizations, who've come together to really promote a return to this dynamic, even militant version of May Day. We conceived of the concept before Tunisia, before Egypt, before Wisconsin, but I guess you can say that facts on the ground have buttressed our argument that the only appropriate May Day in 2011 is a really dynamic day of action. We're calling it a day without workers. Folks can check www.maydayunited.org.
Maydayunited.org.
Maydayunited.org. We're also on Facebook under Mayday United, and you can find a local event in your community that you can organize around, mobilize to, and hopefully we can have a really tremendous outpouring. I don't think any.
You said a day without workers?
A day without workers, yes.
So what does that mean?
That means the working people, the folks who create and produce and serve things of value in this country. We've heard a lot about the demise or the lack of a working class from both the Republican and the Democratic parties, but I think we saw in Egypt most prominently that actually the working class and working people remain the preeminent force in society, the force uniquely suited and able to take on the lack of democracy we see in workplaces. And I don't think we can understand the Wisconsin fight back without understanding the inspiration of the Egyptian example.
Let me ask you a question about that, because here you are, you said this is a very exciting time, I guess partly because of Egypt, partly because of Wisconsin, partly because of what's going on the ground, and yet you see a huge assault going on. I mean, not only continuing to cut taxes for the wealthy, then an austerity budget imposed because there's not enough money, and then when the austerity budget includes the busting of collective bargaining, unions, and any way to organize labor. So you could look at it from another way. You could say
there's really an offensive right now because you don't see taxes going up for the wealthy. You don't see austerity budgets being rejected. You see, in fact, here in New York, we just had one. We're having one shoved down us right now. How do you look at that issue?
Well, let me tell you my point of view. It actually starts going back to the latter part of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century when hundreds of thousands of workers were organized in fighting unions and in community and ethnic-based worker groups. And these organizations positioned themselves as forces which would confront and ultimately bring democracy into the workplace and oppose capitalism. It was a tremendous time for working people and their movements. Of course, we see the birth of the May Day movement in the eight-hour day fight, and of course, the Haymarket martyrs who we lost and will honor here in this country and around the world on May Day. Unfortunately, the 20th century progressed, a combination of repression, co-optation, and internal division led to the rise of this business unionism idea. And the idea shifted from a union which would fight for better wages and working conditions today and tomorrow, ushered democracy into the workplace, shifted into this idea that labor would have a seat at the table with capital, it would have a piece of the pie, there'd be some sort of detente. Well, that detente lasted to some extent, I think you could argue, but I think about 30 years ago in the private sector, capital certainly repudiated that detente and went on the offensive. So unfortunately for those of us who organize in the private sector, the attacks against our brothers and sisters in Wisconsin in the public sector is very familiar. What I do think is different now is the level of fight back. Certainly in my lifetime, I've never seen the energy and combativeness and mobilization in the labor movement. I've asked around during the PATCO strike. People are familiar with Ronald Reagan breaking the strike and union of air traffic controllers. I'm told by people in a position to know that even at that time, the level of resistance from workers and their unions does not match what we're seeing today. So from my point of view, yes, the assaults are heartbreaking. They're extreme. But finally, I think the understanding is starting to emerge that we have to look at this as a class struggle, as a fight. And, you know, sitting here today in a situation where many, many rank-and-file workers and unionists in Wisconsin are talking about the general strike as a practical tool to deal with problems at work.
We thought we were born in another century when we heard that. I mean,
we had to wait a lifetime for this, Mike.
I mean, I couldn't believe it.
I think
the
that's
general
what,
strike?
If your audience could see us now and the smiles beaming on all of our faces, I think it's just remarkable, the achievement in Egypt, which I think we all have to keep pointing out, was born in the struggle of workers, especially the garment workers, women garment workers in Mahalla, who had a day of action in 2008, which led to the Youth Solidarity Movement, which played a large role in the uprising. Of course, there's a tremendous amount of work that remains to be done in Egypt to overtake now the military capitalists that are asserting their dominance. Really, I think we're reminded that revolution and popular struggle and the centrality of workers to transformative change is not something for the history books, and certainly it's very real here in this country. So just could not be more excited about where we at as a workers' movement.
Dan, on May 1st, what kind of a youth movement do you anticipate seeing in the streets? And also, how do you think the police in New York City are going to respond to the numbers that will be flocking
to our public spaces? Yeah, it's a great question. I think the key for May Day this year is we must connect the dots. I think immigrant workers and immigrant leaders have fairly asked, what happened to the movement after 2006? We demonstrated a powerful, powerful direct action in massive numbers. Where were folks? So I think it's critical that we don't forget about the immigrant struggle on May Day, just because the union fight has come to the fore. I think we have to connect the dots. It's the same large corporations and their agents in government who are scapegoating and attacking immigrants. They're the same forces that are attacking any kind of worker organization in the public and the private sector. And they're attacking, as they have been for many years, the ability of non-union workers who are interested in getting into a union. That attack remains extremely ferocious. So I think the key for May Day is connecting the dots with unity. I always anticipate heavy-handed and irresponsible and violent behavior from the police. I think that's a reality. But if people stay strong, stay organized, Mayday United is very lucky to have connected with the National Lawyers Guild, its Labor and Employment Committee, its People of Color Caucus, and of course it'll be working with the Mass Defense Committee to make sure that people's rights are respected.
Dan Gross, MaydayUnited.org. Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
What does organized labor and class activism look like? In New York City, founding member and director of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance, Bharavi Desai, has organized some of the largest taxi strikes in New York City history. The one-day strike in April 1999 brought awareness to issues such as unfair regulations, medical checkups, and health insurance for drivers. Mass activism tactics also included going to court. Desai's activism has created a solidarity with immigrant workers around the world, especially in third world countries where people are forced to migrate to the U.S. for jobs. More than 60% of cab drivers are immigrants from South Asia. Bharavi, who was born in India, has bridged the many cultural differences among them. Bharavi joins us today to talk about her tireless work organizing immigrants not only around labor, but also around quality of life issues.
Bharavi Desai, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
You're the head of a multi-thousand taxi cab drivers union here in New York City, mostly immigrant workers. You've called their plight a sweatshop on wheels. What kind of problems do the men and some women that you represent have right now?
It really is a different mobile sweatshop. The taxi industry, you know, we have 13,237 medallions in New York City. And while the taxi bosses, the companies, are guaranteed a profit every single day, the taxi drivers are not guaranteed an income. Drivers work 12-hour shifts daily. They average 60 to 70-hour work weeks. Every single day, drivers have to pay a lease up front. On a Friday morning, a day driver would be in debt of $150 to $160 within their 12-hour shift. That's how much they need to make just to break even between the lease they pay for the taxi and the medallion, as well as to gas up and other shift incidentals to the companies. Drivers also don't have any health insurance. There is no disability coverage. You know, we're independent contractors, so we're not protected by any of the labor laws like guaranteed income or 8-hour workday.
You're not really a union that's officially recognized as a union. As you said, you're independent drivers.
We call ourselves a union, you know, in the sense that it fights for power for working people in an industry.
You led a strike, how many years ago was it?
It was in 2007. We had 3 days of strikes. In 1988, we also had 3 days of strikes. And, you know, we don't have a strike fund. Not only do drivers pay their lease out of pocket, but, of course, they also lost their income for the day. You know, we have an incredibly courageous and really, you know, visionary membership who is ready to fight every time there's an attack.
Give us a profile of your membership, Bharavi.
You know, our membership is really diverse. Majority of yellow cab drivers in the city are South Asian, 60% from Bangladesh, Pakistan, and India. And we have a very large Haitian membership, a growing Arab membership, particularly from Egypt and Algeria, Morocco. We have a large West African membership from Senegal. We have lots of members from Ghana, from East Africa, Ethiopia, and Eritrea. We call ourselves the Working Class United Nations.
And I know you've led strikes. You've gotten increases in wages of probably 30% over the last 10 years. But, of course, you've had an economic downturn in the last 2 or 3 years. You know, that must have affected the drivers. And I think it also affected, you know, the owners of the leases and how much money they wanted to extract from the drivers. So can you give us some sense over the struggle of the last couple of years between the lessors, the drivers, and the economics?
This is an industry where anytime there's a recession, the bosses are in heaven, because then you have people that are newly unemployed who line up at the garages and the bidding war starts. So you've got the full-time drivers who don't have the same amount of capital because they've been earning low wages for decades in the industry. And then you're matched up against folks who probably had, you know, been working in the financial sector or, you know, other white-collar jobs, but they had been earning more. And then they come out to the garages and are willing to pay a higher lease. And, of course, the bosses always prefer newer workers because they know that the experienced workers, you know, they know their rights. They're more likely to stand up, to demand them. They know that the, you know, old-timers, they recognize that if they have a problem with the boss, they can go to the Taxi Workers Alliance, where somebody who's brand new won't know all of their rights and resources in the industry. We've had a lot of problems with, you know, our senior drivers who, for weeks, sometimes up to months, were unable to find steady work. Expenses have gone up. There's been no job security.
The attack on the state, county, and municipal workers' unions, really to try to destroy those unions, seems to me to be like the opening round of fire, and that what they're really trying to do is to privatize the government organizations that these workers work in. For example, charter schools instead of publicly paid teachers. There's a whole drive on the part of capital to roll things all the way back in this country to before there were unions.
I would say two things. You know, one is when organized labor organizes, it unites, it has the resources to galvanize the entire working class of this nation. There's no question about that. Ultimately, you cannot fight consolidated capital without organized labor. And these folks know public sector unions are, of course, the majority in the labor movement. And so by going after the public sector, they're really trying to destroy the labor movement as a whole. And that's not something that, you know, we're going to take lightly. You know, the taxi drivers of today, we are exactly what happened to the public sector, what is happening to the public sector workers. We used to be employees. We had collective bargaining rights. Drivers were stripped of all of that in the early 80s. Once you go from employee to independent contractor, what they're doing is then stripping you from being a worker and redefining you as a small businessman. The government no longer looks at you as a working person whose, you know, working economic conditions should be protected. Instead, they look at you as a service provider. And so it's all within the framework of consumer rights. And there's no discussion around labor rights in our industry. It's always about the consumer. And that's a very easy, you know, narrative for the government to expand on, given that it's no longer the big corporations that are responsible to the consumer. See, we are the consumer, not the workers and for the bosses. But the riding public is the consumer for the drivers. And so when you continually say the riding public as the consumers should have their rights, the attack then turns on the drivers who are no longer seen as the workers, but instead as these small businessmen. So I think in the future, you know, kids are not going to be young children who benefit from the labor of teachers. Instead, they'll be consumers of education. And, you know, that's a frightening narrative about, you know, of what that will do this to the social fabric of our country.
They would privatize what working people through their taxes have accumulated in terms of government services and just sell them out. For example, an electrical company that's owned by a municipality gets privatized. Mm-hmm. I think that's their ultimate goal. But let me ask you a broader question. What kind of demands, what kind of program would you advocate for working people generally to take us from where we are to where we want to be?
One, you know, we need organization. I mean, collective bargaining and organizing rights, they are fundamental to our humanity. You cannot have democracy in a society if you don't have democracy on the shop floor.
You know, Ohio, as we speak today, just passed even a worse law than Wisconsin did to strip collective bargaining. I mean, it basically says you can negotiate with your local school board or your municipality, and if it fails, you can't even go to arbitration. The last best offer they made to you is the offer that you have to accept. Can you? It's like binding arbitration on one side.
Well, you know, what was amazing to me was a few months ago, we saw the Egyptian masses, an overwhelming majority who live in poor conditions, you know, this amazing, beautiful, powerful revolution that brought down a dictatorship that was financed and, you know, promoted by the West for three decades. And at that same moment in time, we saw Scott Walker, you know, dig in his heels and physically, forcibly remove people from the people's house, the state capitol. And yet we're supposed to believe that this is the house of democracy.
Well, I think that's a really strong point. You know, we take taxis. I know how hard they work, and I think the description you gave us some sense of it. But, you know, a lot of people are working 6 and 7 days a week, 12 hours, and they're still barely making a living. But I'm interested in how are taxi workers organized around the rest of the country? Is the problem we see in New York with being, you know, such exploited workers, is that true of other major cities?
It is throughout the country. The taxi bosses have their own international lobbying groups. The government regulators, because we're a hyper-regulated industry, you know, they have their own international organization as well. But, you know, one thing you should know is throughout the country and really across the globe, man, drivers have been organizing. It's an individualized profession, right? We're not like on a factory floor on an assembly line. And sometimes you can go through an entire week where you've seen maybe five of your colleagues for like an hour each, you know. But we've been finding ways to organize and to build the unity and to build a common platform. We had a membership meeting last week at 1 a.m. We had over 200 drivers come out for the meeting. And we're seeing this in Philadelphia, Los Angeles, Seattle, Boston, Atlanta. You know, we have an international taxi workers alliance. Our brothers and sisters in Nepal are like amazingly organized throughout the world. You know, one thing about drivers is we know the streets are tough, so we're kind of used to bearing that. And we don't exactly believe in borders. And so our solidarity has really gone across the globe. We've been finding ways of working together to make sure that when the bosses have their joint meeting, you know, that the workers are also represented at that table.
But Robbie, just on a personal note, I know that you grew up in New Jersey. Your parents came from India when you were 6 years old. You went to college out in New Jersey, and now you got yourself involved in organizing mostly male taxi cab workers. What is it that motivates you? What are you trying to accomplish in the long run by the kind of organizing that you're doing?
Well, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I love my class. In order to have a world that's truly just and kind and compassionate, you need the majority, the masses of the people, which are the poor and the working class, to really redefine our values, to build systems and structures that are compassionate and kind in their nature. You know, I always knew that I wanted to serve my class, and I can't think of a better way to do that than to work for the labor movement.
Well, just wonderful interview, and we really appreciate your work over the years. I mean, you're an extraordinarily amazing figure in New York and in the country. So thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Barabi.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small. By giving you no time, instead of it all. But we cannot function, we can feel nothing at all. Hurt us at home.